Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sachs. You know, I am old enough to remember when we thought that August of 2021 would be a return to normalcy. Remember when we thought, what are we going to have to talk about? The news cycle is going to slow down. We're going to have the dog days. And yet here we are. Everything is happening. Afghanistan continues to fall. The president of the United States gives a speech yesterday. I would say the reviews are decidedly mixed. And we are joined by my good friend, senior columnist for the Daily Beast, Matt Lewis. Matt, welcome back.
Hey, Charlie. Good to talk with you.
So I would say that objectively speaking, today is pretty much close to the low point for the Biden administration. It does feel like it's a perfect storm for them, at least at the moment. But of course, things change, don't they?
Yeah. What is it they say in baseball? You're never as good as you look when you win. You're never as bad as you look when you lose. But this looks pretty bad right now.
It does look pretty bad. And we're going to get to this because you have a decidedly negative on Biden piece today, comparing the Biden disaster to the Trump disaster. But I want to get into something completely different because I'm a little bit obsessed with this anti-refugee jihad that broke out. But before we get to that, boy, am I convoluted today. So I listened to the president's speech yesterday, and I could go through what I thought he did well and what he did not do well. But I was also listening to the MSNBC coverage, and he finishes the speech, and the commentators were, I would say, somewhat positive. You were listening to the same thing, I think, Matt, right? So, it sounded like they thought it was a strong speech, that the public would agree with it, that here was a president who was, standing by his decision forcefully. And then they pitched to a guest. And if you didn't hear it, this was an epic interview. It is an Afghan veteran. I believe he's a former CIA analyst named Matt Zeller, who heads up an organization devoted to getting our allies from Afghanistan out of the country, the people who had been the military translators, etc. And so I think it's Brian Williams pitches to Matt Zeller. And this is, again, after, I would say, reasonable amount of praise for the president's speech. And Matt Zeller was not having it. Let's play a little bit of that.
I hope he gets on their deaths, too. I feel like I watched a different speech than the rest of you guys. I was appalled. There was such a profound, bold-faced lie in that speech. The idea that we plan for every contingency. I have been personally trying to tell this administration since it took office. I've been trying to tell our government for years that this was coming. We sent them plan after plan on how to evacuate these people. Nobody listened to us. They didn't plan for the evacuation of our Afghan wartime allies. They're trying to conduct it now at the 11th hour. The thing that they were most concerned about was the optics of a chaotic evacuation. Well, they got exactly what they were most concerned of by failing to do what was right when we could have done it. We had all the people and equipment in place to be able to save these people months ago, and we did nothing. I'm appalled that he thinks we only need to take 2,000 people. There's 86,000 people who are currently left behind in Afghanistan alone. We've identified all of them for the government. I have no idea why he claims that people don't want to leave Afghanistan. I have a list of 14,000 names right now of people who want to get out of Afghanistan. And the idea that the Afghan military should be blamed for this, do you know how many casualties the Afghan military took in an average year? More than the United States did in 20. When you're not getting paid on a regular basis, when you're not getting fuel, when no one is supplying you with ammunition, and yet you're still showing up to the fight, how dare us for having to blame these people for not having the audacity to be able to survive a Taliban onslaught? No. What we need to be doing right now, and what I am appalled that the president didn't say, was we need to be talking about how we're going to get every single one of these people out. Because let's be abundantly clear. People like me looked these people in the eye and made them a promise. We promised them that in their time of need, we would take care of them. How do you ever expect anyone to ever trust us again if we don't do that now while we can?
Wow. So, Matt, this is, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. George Packer has a very powerful piece in The Atlantic saying that our abandonment of the Afghans who helped us, counted on us, and staked their lives on us is a final gratuitous shame that we could have avoided. It's a moment that will live in infamy. And I think that a lot of the world thinks of this as a fundamental test of our national honor and decency. And we could go back and forth about whether or not it was a good thing to get out of Afghanistan, who's responsible for it. But the failure to get these allies out just seems to be almost inexplicable. Your take?
Yeah. Wow. Well, there's a lot there. And let me say, you know, I watched Biden's speech, and this was the first time, Charlie, I've been critical of Biden a lot, kind of because it's my job. But up until now, it's been a lot of constructive criticism. And this was the first time that I was actually a little bit pissed off at Joe Biden. In the speech yesterday was infuriating. And I think Jonah Goldberg summed it up best when he tweeted, you know, Biden's take was like, the buck stops with me and I take full responsibility, but my hands were tied by Trump. And this is the Afghan military's fault. And we were prepared for this, but we were caught off guard, you know, and Goldberg goes on and on. And I have to say, just kudos to that guy, Matt Zeller, that you just played the clip of. He brought the receipts. He was obviously passionate, knowledgeable, qualified to make this, you know, rebuke of Biden's speech. And people who've never been on TV, I mean, he's not exactly like a household name. I'm sure he's been on before, but there is a temptation when you go on TV, especially if you're on with someone like, I don't know, Brian Williams, when they toss it to you, to maybe if everybody else has been disagreeing with you, there's a temptation to kind of like soft pedal your comments or like, well, I see what you mean, Brian, but like this guy did not do that. And kudos to him for what he had to say.
So let me disagree with you a little bit. I agreed with what Matt Zeller had to say about the refugees and the allies, and I want to focus on that for a bit. I was not as critical of the rest of the speech as you and Jonah Goldberg were, because I did think he said the buck stops here. He made the decision. He's standing by the decision. He was rather defiant about it. He explained the difference between waging a war against terrorism and anti-insurgency. And frankly, I can't blame him for being angry at the Afghan military for folding in the face of the Taliban. Now, of course, there's another part of that story, which is the our removal of logistical support and air support certainly did not help at all. But this issue of what happens to these translators and members of their family that we promised seems to me to be so fundamental. And it's the one thing that you know, the rest of us can have some say in, and because, you know, the war in Afghanistan is over. It was a disaster. The Taliban are in control, and there's not much that you and I can do about it or say about it that's going to influence public opinion. But what Matt Zeller was doing is saying, look, we have this opportunity and we must. This is, you know, there's a lot of talk about the soul of the nation and, you know, a test of our character and everything. This strikes me as very much a soul of America type moment, not to mention the credibility that we will have in the eyes of the world if we turn our backs, if we say we have no responsibility to these people. Who will ever trust us again? So I teed that up because my reaction and the reaction of a lot of people I respect was, okay, we really have got to get this right. We really have to make sure that these people who fought with us, who supported us, who believed us, whose lives are at risk, who will be, you know, hanged or beheaded if we don't get them out, we need to do something about this. But what was really striking to me, Matt, was how fast the right-wing media pivoted into a really full-throated anti-refugee position here. I mean, there was about 5 minutes when it looked like Trump was suggesting that we take in refugees, but you know that that's not going to happen. So let's start with Charlie Kirk, because some people might have thought this was an outlier. This is Charlie Kirk is one of the genuine deplorables, very, very, very Trumpy, very MAGA, head of Turning Point USA. And here he is in this clip, and I'm not making this up, saying that Joe Biden intentionally lost Afghanistan so he could flood the country with refugees, who he described as Ilhan Omars, as part of the transformation of American politics. This is the great replacement theory applied to Afghanistan. Let's play Charlie Kirk.
President Joe Biden's Department of Defense will accept 30,000 Afghan refugees into military installations following the collapse of Kabul. Political transformation.
Ooh.
Let the country crumble. Do you know there's 5 million displaced people in Afghanistan now? This was all intentional. Joe Biden let it fall apart to now say, oh, I'm so sorry. I guarantee you Joe Biden's speech this afternoon will talk about refugee assistance and relocation support. Now, Joe Biden's going to be scrambling to make good on it, and the liberal media will love it. They'll say, oh, yes, okay, now I get it. Joe Biden is now fixing his own problem. Joe Biden is stepping up, and he's allowing a flow of people from the Middle East into America. Thank you, Joe Biden. You're such a hero. You're so benevolent. You're so respectful. You're so compassionate. Do you see what's going on here?
What's going on here
is Joe Biden wants a couple hundred thousand more Ilhan Omars to come into America.
What?
To change the body politic permanently.
Replacement.
We're playing checkers, and they're playing chess.
Okay, I probably should point out that Ilhan Omar is Somali, not Afghan, but I guess they all look alike to Charlie Kirk, right? I mean, that's the point that, but this is the great replacement theory, right? We're bringing in these brown, you know, brown-skinned immigrants, and they're going to replace us. It's all about, and they're all going to vote, right? and when I first saw that, I thought, okay, that's Charlie Kirk, you know, his blend of pure stupidity and raw bigotry, but it's not a one-off at all. I mean, Stephen Miller, the former immigration Rasputin for the Trump administration, he tweeted out, it's becoming increasingly clear that Biden and his radical deputies will use their catastrophic debacle in Afghanistan as a pretext for doing to America what Angela Merkel did to Germany and Europe. And almost on cue, even as these desperate allies are trying to flee the Taliban, Tucker Carlson goes on Fox News and labels them invaders who will be coming to your neighborhood. Let's play Tucker.
So we're getting it. And if history is any guide, and it's always a guide, we will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we're invaded. It is always the same.
Invaders. See that? And of course, Laura Ingraham goes on and goes, what promises? We don't owe these people anything. Here's Laura.
And is it really our responsibility to welcome thousands of potentially unvetted refugees from Afghanistan?
They're vetted.
All day we've heard phrases like, we promised them. Well, who did? Did you?
We did.
Well.
Wow. Okay. So, Matt, this has become the thing. J.D. Vance is also pushing a statement saying, you know, there may be some good Afghans, but there are bad people out there as well, and they're not going to be vetted. This strikes me as this is the next big thing. Okay. This is the next big argument. It's kind of the old one where, you know, it's the invaders, caravans, why we need walls, disease-infested migrants who are spreading the pandemic. And now it's these invaders from Afghanistan. I mean, you know, just when you thought these cultural wars were going to subside, this is going to be ugly.
Yeah. Well, and then look, I think of it, though, if you had a conservative show like on Fox right now. I mean, you can't criticize the withdrawal because Trump was for that and started it. You could criticize the execution, but that's kind of boring.
It's terrible. It's pretty bad.
No, you could certainly talk about the execution being like completely ham-fisted and a really debacle, but I don't think that is as interesting to this audience as the culture war stuff. You know, that's why we don't talk about like spending anymore, right? We talk about Dr. Seuss. And so I think that the part about invaders is really throwing red meat to this audience. Like, obviously, Charlie, we should vet people before they come. That should have been handled better. But like, I would just say three things about what we just heard. Like, number one, it's obviously a conspiracy theory, you know. Number two, you know, I know like, and Tucker, I worked for Tucker for 6 years. I really like Tucker personally, but, you know, I know he went after Mitt Romney. I mean, like, you know, people like Tucker and Laura Ingraham, I would say probably had more to do with this than like Mitt Romney. I mean, they had, you know, TV shows and a platform, and I think we're probably cheering on the Afghan invasion. Just like almost everybody in America was at the time. And then lastly, Charlie, I think is just the like point that you've been making, which is like what would motivate someone to oppose helping people who like put their lives on the line and risk their lives for us? You know, just out of loyalty. And I think whether we're talking about defending the Kurds, this was a big topic a couple years ago, or protecting these interpreters from the Taliban. This is about like decency and honor and fulfilling your commitment. And if you don't fulfill commitments, people eventually will notice that.
This strikes me as a fundamentally conservative value that you would support the people who supported us in a military operation. The pivot to blame the military, to blame our allies. It's extraordinary. And look, I know you and I have talked about this before, that sometimes, everything is called racist, but the way in which they have embraced this anti-immigrant fervor, and that it's all, let's stoke the xenophobia, the outrage, the fear. It's clearly their most, their most comfortable playbook, but to apply it to the Afghans, many of whom saved Americans' lives, the stories that you're hearing from American soldiers who are coming back and saying, look, we couldn't have functioned without these guys. We made a promise to these guys. I just wonder how that's going to play, or whether it's going to play exactly the way the caravan issue played back in 2018, which is that a lot of people are thinking, they're coming to my neighborhood, these people, and they speak a funny language and they have accents and maybe they're Muslims. Well, they are Muslims, but I guess it's just so ugly. Well, it seems like such a fundamental test of decency.
It is. Tom Nichols had a piece, I think it was in The Atlantic, where he talked about maybe this is who we are. It may be. I mean, I think there probably are going to be a lot of people in middle America all of a sudden who are not that keen on, trying to rescue these refugees. And it's going to be because, not because they thought of it themselves, but because of what they're being, kind of fed, by these pundits.
Well, also, we're having this interesting debate going back and forth about, the role of, look, there's no question this was botched. And this happened on Biden's watch. He did not have to, follow through on all the policies that he inherited. But it is ironic listening to the MAGA folks on this, because Trump was absolutely clear, absolutely definitive in wanting to get out of Afghanistan. Long before he was president, he was tweeting it out. A month ago, he gave a speech where he said, I began this process. Biden, couldn't get out of it. He put out a statement in April saying that Biden was waiting too long to get out, that he should have pulled out earlier, all of this stuff. And yet, there is kind of a memory holding of the fact that, Trump signed an agreement that not only committed us to pulling out, but also released, hundreds or thousands of Taliban prisoners. There was a different – David French wrote a piece about this Trump-Taliban deal back in 2019. Yeah. He said there's a difference between peace and retreat. And this looks like way worse than just retreat. I mean, it looks like you're just handing over, all of this, the entire store and the keys and everything, and the credit cards to the Taliban. And that happened in 2019. And you listen to some of the Republican criticism of Biden. And look, I agree with you that Biden, deserves a lot of the criticism he's getting. It's really kind of absurd. I mean, remember when Trump wanted to have a secret meeting at the Taliban at Camp David?
On 9/11. Yeah, on 9/11. It's insanity. Trump deserves a ton of blame for this, a ton of blame. I do think it's possible that, ironically, that if Trump had been, reelected, that the withdrawal may have gone smoother initially. But I just think ultimately the Taliban was going to take over. It may not have been the debacle, partly because I think the military brass might have kind of slow rolled the things he wanted to do, and he may have been there may have been more pushback.
I don't know.
It's just purely speculative. But
yeah, Trump
deserves a lot of blame, a ton of blame for this. But I think one of the things that bothers me, Charlie, is that it used to be that the Republican Party and conservatives would serve as a check. So whether we were talking about things like governmental spending or whether we were talking about things like you know, unilateral surrender and a withdrawal. And that the Republican Party would be in opposition, like a bulwark against these more liberal ideas. And I think that part of what happened with Donald Trump is when he embraced things like spending and he embraced things like withdrawal from Afghanistan, that there wasn't anybody filling that role as the opposition party. And so I can't help but think that's part of this story.
Oh, it's very much a part of this story, you know, that in order to sustain a military enterprise like this, you need to have public support. In order to have public support, you need to have leaders who articulate the value of the mission. And for the last 4 years, you had a president who said, this is pointless. We shouldn't be here. We should get out. And so you did have that bipartisan consensus. And I think this is what Tom Nichols was getting at. You know, I think the last time before this all fell apart, they polled it. It was like 70% of Americans were like, yeah, let's get out. Let's bug out because, you know, liberals didn't want to fight in the Middle East. And the Republicans, who would have normally been a little bit more, you know, forceful about it, they had been influenced by Trump to think that this was a waste of our time and our treasure and lives. And so there wasn't really no constituency for it. And then, of course, we see these pictures. I actually did think that Liz Cheney had a pretty balanced, one of the few people who had a pretty balanced. I understand that just saying the name Cheney is going to get people's hair on fire listening to this. But I thought she had a pretty balanced assessment. She was on ABC and asked about who was responsible for this. Let me just play that.
Whether they can count on us for anything.
You know, ultimately, this is President Biden's decision. He is the one that is called for this withdrawal, is going forward with it. But this didn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, right. It was President Trump that negotiated the agreement with the Taliban to have a complete withdrawal that was supposed to actually happen by May 1st. So who bears responsibility?
Look, I think absolutely President Biden bears responsibility for making this decision. But there is no question that President Trump, his administration, Secretary Pompeo, they also bear very significant responsibility for this. They walked down this path of legitimizing the Taliban, of perpetuating this fantasy, telling the American people that the Taliban were a partner for peace. President Trump told us that the Taliban was going to fight terror. Secretary Pompeo told us that the Taliban was going to renounce al-Qaeda. None of that has happened. None of it has happened. Today, as we watch the Taliban, for example, release prisoners across Afghanistan, there's very real concern that there are not just fighters in those prisons who will join the battle in Afghanistan, but that terrorist groups globally will, in fact, be fed new soldiers in their war on terror from those prisons. It's a devastating set of circumstances, but the delegitimization of the Afghan government, the notion in the Trump administration, the suggestion that at one point they were saying we're going to invite the Taliban to Camp David.
September 11th.
Yeah. Oof. I mean, this disaster certainly began. And look, the notion of we're going to end endless wars, that campaign slogan. What we're watching right now in Afghanistan is what happens when America withdraws from the world. So everybody who has been saying America needs to withdraw, America needs to retreat, we are getting a devastating, catastrophic, real-time lesson in what that means.
Okay. So, Matt, any comments on that?
Yeah, two things. One, I think that Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger have been amazing. I wish we had a political party full of Liz Cheney's and Adam Kinzinger's right now. Instead, they're literally two of them. The second thing I want to talk about, going back to a comment you made a second ago about, you know, how because Trump and Biden and Obama all wanted to get out of Afghanistan, there really wasn't any public support. And that is true. But I think this is, you know, I was noting how, like, I was watching MSNBC after Biden's speech yesterday, and, you know, Nicole Wallace came on, and she was basically saying, like, I know all of the elites out there think that Biden's speech was bad, but I bet you the American public loved it because nobody wants to be here. And, you know, it is true that, like, around 70% of the public wanted to withdraw, but there's an, you know, this is the problem with leading by looking at the polls, right? So there's a Politico, a Morning Consult Politico poll that says just 49% of voters continue to support the withdrawal, down from 69% in April. Like, the public are fickle, and this is such a big, I guess what I'm saying here is that I really don't like, there's two arguments I think being used right now to kind of silence criticism of Biden and what's going on. And one of them is like, you're not an expert. And we could talk about that, but I think that's a bogus argument to make to silence, you know, people who are concerned about what's happening. And the other one is like, well, the public wants to do this. The public doesn't want to be there. It's like, well, leaders don't just look at public polls. And by the way, the public, like the vicissitudes of public opinion are not the best way to lead.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, especially because, let's face it, you know, Americans had stopped paying attention to the war in Afghanistan a long time ago. Most people hadn't even thought about it. So
yeah, which in my opinion is an argument for, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Like, I felt like this was like a solution in need of a problem that Joe Biden has dropped on us, on him.
So let's talk about the crisis of the Biden presidency and how badly this has damaged him and what this means for our politics. But let's take a quick break first. And when we come back, Matt, I want to talk to you about your piece, because you kind of break bad on Joe Biden, saying it's a disaster. But also, I think it's worth looking at all the different things that are happening right now, because this is not an isolation. And things have turned very, very quickly in politics, because remember, like a lifetime ago, like last Tuesday, Joe Biden had this massive political victory in the United States Senate. And yet, look where we are right now. We will be right back with Matt Lewis. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to The Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like the Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. Okay, we're back with the Daily Beast's Matt Lewis. Let me just read you the lead, Matt, from a Washington Post article by Matt Visor this morning, which I know you've seen. Joe Biden presented voters with a core argument why he, more than anyone else, was the best choice to replace the wildly unorthodox Donald Trump. He would bring competence. Biden said that as president, he would restore calm order to the vast federal bureaucracy. He vowed to reaffirm America's place in the world. He touted how he knew world leaders, how his deep foreign policy expertise would lend itself to the world stage, making things right and helping to correct past wrongs. But over the past few days, the images from Afghanistan have put on vivid display, and here it comes, an inability to plan, an underestimation of a foreign adversary, an ineffective effort to scramble and make up for it, and as Biden demonstrated in a brief address Monday, an attempt to deflect full responsibility. Wow, that's the front page of the Washington Post. And I guess this is the moment that what we thought we were getting with Joe Biden, the candidate, is really under, the nicest way I can put it is under siege this week. You would go further than that, though.
Yeah, well, I thought that was well written and well said. And look, I mean, there was a time when Joe Biden was kind of seen as certainly by conservatives, as a bit of a joke. And I think that Donald Trump was just so bad, so chaotic, so evil, that, you know, by comparison, a lot of us kind of wanted to believe that Joe Biden had like changed. And I do think that as he got older, in the campaign, he was just perfectly cast to be this contrast to Donald Trump. But we can't forget that, like, Joe Biden has been wrong about every like foreign policy decision. I had a column the other day where I talked about, like, he opposed the Persian Gulf War, which, by the way, was a great success, but later reversed his decision and criticized George H.W. Bush, saying that Bush should have gone all the way to Baghdad and taken out Saddam Hussein, which would have been, as we learned later, a disaster. Then he supported the Iraq War before opposing the surge Then as vice president, he opposed the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, which brings us to Afghanistan, right? I mean, like, there was not a lot of reason to believe that Joe Biden was actually gonna be this steady hand, at least when it comes to foreign policy. And the idea that, like, the adults are back in charge, I wanted to believe it. But, like, the last time I heard that, it was when George W. Bush took over from Bill Clinton and Rumsfeld and Cheney. Came in office. So
you write in your column today, it is amazing how quickly Biden's aspirations appear to be falling apart. With the infrastructure bill passing the Senate less than a week ago, there was some optimism. But hot Joe summer is already a mess and winter is coming. Winter is coming. So you're a Game of Thrones guy, aren't you?
Not really, but I think that is darn good writing, if I say so myself.
Okay. Even if, after 20 years, the American public is indifferent to the plight of Afghanistan, or will be by the time 2024 comes around, I have been documenting looming problems like inflation, violent crime, and out-of-control border. Problems Biden initially dismissed as transitory or cyclical. There was also his independence from COVID-19 remarks that, with the rise of the Delta variant, feel like a wildly premature mission accomplished declaration. And you basically say, so far he's kind of been given a pass by the media and the public, but watching what's happened in Afghanistan, it's a blow to his credibility on all of those other issues as well. And I think that's the key point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. We don't know how things are going to turn out. However, there was a time when Joe Biden seemed to have the wind at his back. So first of all, he's taking over and inheriting the presidency from a horrible person who was a horrible president, right? So right away, by contrast, you look good. You look better maybe than you are. It felt like COVID was, maybe not in the rear view, but we were poised to on Biden's watch to kind of go past it. Things are going to open up again. Vaccines are going to be rolled out. And there was talk about him being like the next FDR or LBJ doing, this big stuff. That sort of slumped a little bit. I think there was a recalibration because we started hearing about things like inflation and crime and the border, which I think Biden very cavalierly dismissed, I think, wrongly. But I think that there was a sense like, okay, Biden, maybe he's not going to be FDR, but he's going to get this bipartisan infrastructure thing passed. And it'll at least be, a feather in his cap. And now I think we are at a point where when you look at what's happening in Afghanistan, which, I'm sorry, it does look like the fall of Saigon. When you look at what's happening with COVID, in the case of the Delta variant, and we don't know where that's going to go. And then you throw on the stuff that I mentioned, the inflation still looming, violent crime, and the border, like all of a sudden, it's not over yet, but this is a guy who does have, he's got some challenges, let's just say, facing him.
No, it did. I think I wrote last week, Biden agonistes, that it felt like his presidency was sort of at the hinge of fate point with all of those things coming together, any of which poses a significant challenge. We've seen what inflation can do to a presidency, not to mention crime and the border. And I guess the question is, how much political will does he have to deal with some of these things? For example, Political Playbook reports that one of the reasons why they were not more aggressive in getting the refugees out of Afghanistan was they were afraid of exactly the kind of, Republican blowback that you're seeing now. But in light of, he's already on the defensive on the border, did not want to have thousands of refugees. So, I think a lot of this raises questions about the decision making. And this is an opportunity to recalibrate. There's been a certain triumphalism and complacency on the left that, because they are not Donald Trump, that just simply push everything through because they have that wind at their back. I don't think that survives this week. And that may not be a bad thing.
No, it would actually
confidence is,
Every presidency begins with people thinking that the rules don't apply to them anymore. And that they've cracked the code and they've figured something new out. And so getting over that quickly I think is successful. I do wonder, though, and I have to say again, look, I'm not saying that I am, this is very anecdotal, and I'm not saying that I'm like indicative of a lot of Americans out there, but yesterday during that speech was kind of the first time that I'm like, oh, I feel like a Republican again. Like, I don't like this Joe Biden. And before I'm like, I kind of felt bad writing bad things about him. He seems like this nice guy. And now I'm like, oh, now he's blaming everyone else. Like, and I saw, again, totally anecdotal, but I saw people on Twitter.
Yeah, but Twitter's not real life.
It's not.
Man.
No, again, but these are people, it's very self-selective, but real people, not bots, who basically said, like, I'm not going to, you know, I voted for him before. Basically, these are never Trump conservatives. I'm not going to vote for him again. When you look at that Pew survey that came out a couple months ago that showed that Biden actually won the election by virtue of not by virtue of turning out like the Obama base in large numbers, but by doing better among white men, for example, than most Democrats do. Again, I don't know if any one incident completely erodes that, but this election in 2020 was still pretty close in three states,
no,
Charlie.
So
it's not crazy to think that Donald Trump could get back in there with this stuff happening.
Well, see, that's the scary thing, and I think you make this point in your column. I mean, you know, what's worse than, you know, a failed presidency? Well, it's a failed presidency replaced by another failed presidency, or even worse than that. So, you know, what have we done to deserve Trump, Biden replaced again by Trump? So then that's the concern. It's why, I mean, I root for Biden not because I agree with everything that he is doing, but because he is the bulwark against the return of Donald Trump, because that replacement is even worse. Okay, so right before we started this, we were talking about something that you had written that feels like a lifetime ago, but which is still relevant. I mean, the world goes on. We know the big story today is that the administration is going to recommend a third shot, a third vaccine for certain vulnerable patients after 8 months. I'll take it if it's offered. I think that's a no-brainer. But we continue to have this ongoing culture war in places like Texas and Florida and South Dakota about masking. And you had a devastating piece about Ron DeSantis' approach to this. So talk to me a little bit about that, because that's not changing and that's not getting any better, especially with school reconvening and the number of teachers down in Florida who are contracting COVID and are dying of COVID, while the governor is waging this massive campaign against masking rules, and apparently had a press conference yesterday where he's pushing Regeneron or something like that. So what is Ron DeSantis doing right now?
Well, it's funny, yeah, Charlie. I was originally going to come on here and bash Ron DeSantis, and attack Republicans, which I'm perfectly happy to do, especially when they deserve it, as they almost always do. The piece was basically about how, you know, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott also are basically, you know, telling local communities that the local communities cannot make a decision to require students to wear masks. And in the case of DeSantis, he later backed off of this. But in the case of DeSantis, he actually was threatening to, punish local school board and administrators who defied him by fining them or withholding their pay. And I wrote a piece basically making the point that, like, look, DeSantis may legally be entitled, may have the right to do this sort of bullying tactic that he's engaged in. And I also think it's performative, obviously, for political reasons. But it's certainly not conservative. And I went through and cited, you know, Paul Ryan talking about subsidiarity, about how, you know, quote, government closest to the people governs best. I talked about Hayek and warning about the knowledge problem and central planners. And I even quoted some Edmund Burke in there about the little platoons. And basically, I think made the case that what Ron DeSantis is doing is a whole lot of things, but it's not It's not conservative what he's doing.
Well, and again, for people, because we often have a hard time defining what conservative is. And for our listeners, you know, this concept of subsidiarity was also always very important. I think it came from Catholic social thought, which essentially the argument is, you correct me, or if you can put it better, is that decisions should be made as close to, you know, as close to the ground as possible. Local control or states' rights, you know, may seem like these slogans, but the basic principle of subsidiarity is that the people who are closest, or most intimately involved, are best positioned to make the decision, as opposed to centralized planners. You know, you mentioned Hayek. Think they understand all the problems, but life and the world is so complex, and the planners often don't know as much as they think they know, which is why conservatives had up until 5 minutes ago been very suspicious of central planning, top-down management, and why they thought that local communities, local little platoons should, you know, churches and school districts, et cetera, should be able to make decisions about their own lives as opposed to somebody sitting in, say, you know, on the throne in Tallahassee.
Yeah. Which is 7 hours away if you're in Miami. I mean, it's a big state, and so it's not the same as like the federal government telling every small community what to do. But it's still far removed from and it's reasonable to believe that the situation on the ground in different parts of a big state may actually be different. It's possible to believe that the culture is different. And so I think this was a big problem. It's not conservative. And I also think it's bullying. I think it's also just indicative of a guy who is prioritizing winning the 2024 Republican presidential primary over actually serving as a good governor of his state.
Well, the other thing that strikes me is that conservatives used to, base their beliefs on what they called ordered liberty. They had this vision of ordered liberty, which is two parts, which is, yes, you are free, but it's balanced by certain responsibilities to the community so that you would balance rights with responsibilities. I mean, how many conversations did we have about this, that merely because you have the right to do something doesn't mean that it is the right thing to do? I cannot tell you how many times I had that argument when I was on the radio. And yet this whole argument about masks, you know, it seems like suddenly the conservative movement has thrown out all of those balancing tests of ordered liberty, and it's essentially the spoiled, petulant adolescent, I don't want to. I just, my freedom trumps any danger to the rest of the community, and I'm going to do whatever I want. So somehow freedom became not just this sort of out of control spiraling narcissism, and it's embraced by people like Ron DeSantis.
It totally is. And I have to say, Charlie, that's a very Burkean, ordered liberty. I love that, that formulation. And I think it's just maybe the best, most, the best way to describe like my conservative philosophy. And I think you get either of those two things out of whack. You know, order is important, right? We can't have a society if we're in chaos, if there's violence. So you need order, right? But not authoritarianism, right? We also need to preserve freedom and liberty. And I think like if you fetishize either of those two things, and if you get out of balance with either of those two things, then you have anarchy or tyranny, like one or the other, right? And so we really need to balance those. It's I would say it's prudent to balance those. Prudence is a conservative thing. And I think that that what we're seeing in the case of people like DeSantis is that this is getting out of whack a little bit too far toward the like, hey man, my body, my choice. Well, I'm pro-life, so that's not really that's not a really good. Wow. Like, I think you should wear a mask if appropriate.
Well, that's also an incoherent argument because, you know, when they say my body, my choice, what they're doing is they're trolling pro-choice individuals. But trolling is not a principle, right? So one of the understandings of the pro-life movement have been is that we prioritize life over, sometimes over freedom, right? So again, they're taking a position that they don't actually believe in. I mean, clearly they don't believe that. So
everybody pretty much are hypocrites on this right now.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, it's funny because the my body, my choice thing illustrates hypocrisy in the case of progressives who want to mandate masks, but are pro-choice. And I think it illustrates hypocrisy on conservatives who are pro-life, but hey man, do whatever you want with the mask. If you spread, if you don't wear it and you spread a virus, like that's too bad. And you know, there's another example too, Charlie, of this hypocrisy, which is the thing about forcing someone to bake a cake, right? You know, conservatives used to say like, I don't think you should, force a baker to violate his rights of conscience and bake a cake. But yet, Ron DeSantis thinks it's okay to force, cruise ships or cruise lines to not have vaccine passports, so-called vaccine passports. So, yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy here.
Yeah, it's almost, I'm not sure even, going past hypocrisy to just the complete lack of any principle whatsoever. You know, everything is like, every idea, every argument is simply a cudgel. And you pick it up depending on who you want to bash, and you're prepared to drop that cudgel and turn it around no matter what. Okay, I'm now being somewhat opaque. But it's just noticing how people...
Yeah, and it becomes nihilistic, right? I mean, at some point, we don't believe in anything. We're not honorable. We don't have principles. It's really just about power. And that's a horrible position to be in. And I have to say, not to take a cheap shot, but I think that Donald Trump, this kind of started with Donald Trump, I think.
Well, no, that's not a cheap shot. And it would be comforting to think it started with Donald Trump, but obviously it was a pre-existing condition. And I always think of, people as having, listening to the better angels of their nature or, their more, their darker impulses. And what Donald Trump did was he just opened the doors of, all that Pandora's box of all the darker impulses said, you don't have to be decent. You don't have to have character. You don't have to tell the truth. You don't have to be kind. You don't have to ever admit error. You can just be as nihilistic as possible as long as you're punching the right people in the face. And that has spread from him. I mean, he gave permission. And now you see, I mean, if he dropped over dead tomorrow, that legacy would still exist because that culture is out there. It's like, feels like it's been loosed.
Yeah.
And,
there've always been like sort of situational things, like whichever party, is the minority likes the filibuster, right? And whatever party,
right.
Like that's always been like, where you stand depends on where you sit. But I do think that at least for most of my lifetime, there was like conservative dogma. And that we were pretty principled and I think that now it really is just about, in the wake of Trump, it really is just about power.
And that's the world. And that's the world we live in. Matt Lewis, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.